Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Happy Friday. It's August 18th. We're so glad you're with us today. You know, as Christians, we have the inside track of what's going on. It's all in black and white. We can go read God's word. And I'll get us started with a little bit from Philippians, starting in chapter 1, verse 9, 10, and 11. It says, "And this is my prayer, that your love may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight, so that you may be able to discern," big word there, "discern what is best, and may be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God." So let's grow in our depth, our insight, our knowledge, our love, that we can have that discernment to know what is best and pure and blameless for the day of Christ.
Where was that again?
That is Philippians 1, 9, 10, and 11.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You are welcome. So it's interesting whenever they want to, they have syntaxes. I love the fact that we're using the word sin more and more in the world. At least we're getting it out there. We're having more opportunities to discuss sin.
Because who doesn't want to do that?
Of course. But I love the idea. The government wants to regulate an activity. So there's that they have an activity that they don't want you to do, so they're going to tax it. And then they take the money that they get from taxing it, and they use it for something, which they begin to rely on. So they need you to continue to do the activity that they're trying to discourage you from doing with higher taxes. I don't know.
It's a vicious cycle, isn't it?
It starts to feel like a cycle, doesn't it?
Is greed a sin? Can we tax greed?
Yes.
Are we allowed to do that?
I don't know. So Chris Martin is on our line. He's going to be coming up next. We're going to talk to the millennial evangelical. We're going to start talking about online harassment. You know, Chris spends a lot of time online, where his whole life is. And he's got some lessons on that he can teach us with online harassment. And we're going to talk to him about that. And then we have Professor Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog, who will be in studio in this later part of the hour. So we're going to look forward to that conversation as well. So we have a great hour plan. Stick around. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Thanks for listening. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Chris Martin, a regular contributor on the show. We think of him as the millennial evangelical. And Chris, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Say, way cool on your devotional on He Reads Truth.
Thanks. Yeah,
Talk about that, my second one.
Yeah, sure. It's my second one. I think I my first one ran like last week. And it's funny, they work so far out. I like almost forgot that they were coming up because I wrote them back in like May.
Okay.
because you know they're getting these plans ready because they've got to coordinate it all and coordinate writers and stuff. I just finished writing three more, two on minor prophets and one on Esther that I think will come out later in the fall or early winter. So my wife loves She Reads Truth, so she like thinks it's really cool that I get to write for He Reads Truth. But it's just one of those, you know, I met the guy who runs it. He lives here in Nashville. It's one of the benefits of living in Nashville, really. Mm-hmm. And a couple of my friends write for the site as well, Barnabas Piper and Brandon Smith. And so I kind of got in on it, and it's a really neat site. I like what they do.
Yeah, I know those names, and I think I'm looking forward to reading your devotional. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I will look forward to it. And if our listeners want to go to their HeReadsTruth.com. And, of course, the SheReadsTruth.com, very popular website.
Yes.
So, yeah, we gave away the She Reads Truth Bibles, and they were a big hit.
Those things are
huge.
Those things are going like hotcakes.
Oh, yes, they are. Yes, they are. All right, let's talk about online harassment. I'm hoping to have some myself.
I hope not. you know, the likelihood is most young people have experienced online harassment of some kind. 67% of people ages 18 to 29 have experienced online harassment. 33% of folks 30 and older have, which just makes sense based on online activity. But this report from Pew came out back earlier in the summer, and I just haven't made time to write on it until now.
Mm-hmm.
Online harassment, we all know that it's a big problem. I mean, if we didn't know before the 2016 election cycle, we knew after the 2016 election cycle, because most of us were harassed in some major or minor form probably during the 2016 election if we were online really at all and expressed any interest in the election. So I think that's part of why they kind of released this data. So basically, online harassment is a huge problem, and one of the sad things about it is not many of us are doing anything about it. We all have, not all of us, a lot of us, majority of us have strong convictions about it. We think it's a problem. But not all of us have heard a whole lot about it. And, not all of us think it's a major problem. So mm-hmm. only 62% of us think it's a major problem. In fact, we think a violation of privacy or fake news, we think that more of us think those are major problems than harassment, which obviously those are major problems, but I would venture to say harassment is at least that major. Mm-hmm. Especially certain kinds of harassment, mm-hmm. more serious forms. 46% of young people ages 18 to 29 have been called names online. 37% have been purposefully embarrassed. 25% have experienced physical threats. 16% have experienced sustained harassment, so over a long period of time. 15% have experienced sexual harassment. And 13% of people have experienced stalking online. Women experience online harassment far more than men, which isn't super shocking, just because I think it's probably fair to say they're going to experience more sexual harassment than mm-hmm. men. Especially in the online space. And so it's a big problem, but we're not doing a whole lot about it. I think we have this sort of learned helplessness. So you may or may not be familiar with the Martin Seligman, and he's a psychologist from the 1960s. He did this test on dogs to figure out learned helplessness. Well, really he was testing to figure out more about depression in humans. Mm-hmm. So to summarize and oversimplify his experiments, here's basically what he did. He took dogs, paired them up, put them in harnesses. They were in this enclosure. He shocked some of them. He shocked all of them. Some of them, their shock could be stopped if they just hit this lever, if they flicked this little lever and it would stop their shock. Some of the dogs, if they flicked the lever, it would not stop the shock. And so then he moved them to this different enclosure at a later time with the same dogs. And when they were in, you know, half of this enclosure that they were in, they were being shocked. But if they would move to the other side of the enclosure, they would stop being shocked. So the set of dogs whose lever worked in the previous experiment, they moved over to the other side of the enclosure and were like, oh, okay, that's how we stopped the shock this time. They kind of learned how to prevent being shocked.
Mm-hmm.
The dogs who previously their lever did not work, their lever did not prevent them from being shocked, they didn't even try to move to the other side of the enclosure, even when they saw that their other dogs in the experiment were being free from the shock. They just kind of stayed where they were and just took it.
Mm.
So that's a massive oversimplification, but all of that to say, that's where this kind of term learned helplessness came from. It's a common like counseling term. I know I've heard it a lot in the counseling space that like if you've experienced, you know, significant trauma throughout your life, the bad things have happened to you or whatever, you can get this sort of learned helplessness where you just feel like it's not even worth fighting anymore. And I think a lot of times we have that in various areas in our life, and I think that's where we are in online harassment. I think earlier in the social internet, perhaps we were a little bit more voracious in our fighting of trolling and harassment. I know I was. Like I used to, if I saw someone harassing one of my friends or someone I followed online, I would hop in there and try to defend them on their behalf, you know, on Twitter or something like that, and be like, hey, back off, you jerk, or whatever. But now – if I see people harassing or arguing or whatever, I just kind of stay out of it because I've learned that it's sort of helpless. I've seen so many people try and fail to stop online harassment that, you know, even if someone is trolling or harassing me, I just tend to kind of ignore them or block them. I don't even try to engage them if they're harassing me. So I'm even less likely to engage if they're harassing someone else. So it's sad that we're not defending each other from this harassment, but I think we've kind of learned to be helpless.
Mm-hmm. Is a very interesting story, Chris, an interesting analogy about learned helplessness. As I'm thinking of, nearly 1 in 10 Americans have experienced high levels of anxiety through harassment. Let's talk about just the cost-benefit analysis. I mean, there is a way to remove yourself from this harassment, and that is to get offline.
Yeah. I think if you're being harassed online, that certainly would that would fix your problem. Now, a lot of people, and I think rightfully so, a lot of people would say, well, you know, people harassing me shouldn't prevent me from getting to experience online things. You know, connecting with my friends on Instagram or Facebook. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't.
Good morning. It's 19 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Chris Martin. We like to think of him as the millennial evangelical. You can actually go to millennialevangelical.com and see Chris's writings and thinking. Chris, let's talk about some of the ways we can build people up online and the strange, weird burden of being in and on social media.
Yeah, I think the strange burden of social media comes from it simply being a stewardship issue. You know, if you're using social media at all, you're kind of been given this responsibility to steward it well. It's a tool. I think it can be a negative tool, it can be a positive tool. I think it's relatively neutral, and it's kind of what you make of it. In our sin, unfortunately, it's more negative than positive most times. But here are, I think, three simple ways you can redeem the medium of social media and kind of make it a God-glorifying experience and tool for you to use. I think first, you can create encouraging dialogue. So there's a lot of negativity. I mean, we were just talking about harassment for like 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of negativity online, and certain platforms have more negativity than others. But I think one of the ways you can redeem social media is just by creating encouraging dialogue. If you see a blog post from someone you like, find them on Twitter and encourage them. Or mm-hmm. if someone that you follow on Instagram posts a really cool picture that they took, tell them that's a great photo, that they're a great photographer, or whatever. Just kind of create encouraging dialogue, inject positivity, even if it seems trivial. If you're like, man, I enjoyed myself reading that or seeing that or watching that, tell the person so.
Mm-hmm.
Two, share trustworthy resources. So a lot of listeners or Christians online in general are probably reading Christian blogs like He Reads Truth or like, you know, all of these other great sites out there. Share trustworthy resources. Share resources that will encourage people, will build people up in their faith, or point people to Jesus. I think that's one of the best ways Christians can use social media. And then third and finally, build sanctifying relationships. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, it would have been weird to say this, but I've built a number of sanctifying, God-glorifying friendships that started on social media. Like, I have a number of friendships today that that I've met these people in person, or now, you know, I might live among these people in person, who I first met on Twitter when I was in college, you know, 5 years ago or 6 years ago. And so use social media to build sanctifying relationships with people that you may only meet when you both happen to be at a conference, or you pass them in the airport or something like that. But you can really kind of build a relationship with people and commiserate about things or co-labor in some project online, perhaps. But social media, you can create real relationships with people. I think a lot of people unfortunately see everything about social media being trivial, so that any relationship you were to make with a stranger on social media would have to be surface level or have no depth. And I don't think that's the case. I think you can really make true brothers and sisters in Christ as friends on social media. It's, you know, the platform online, social media, is kind of a volatile beast, and it's not to be taken lightly or underestimated as a potential force of evil. So I think it's good to make friends and share trustworthy resources, kind of shed the gospel light there, and create some encouraging dialogue that's building people up rather than harassing people or tearing people down.
Chris, I'm really encouraged to hear that you've established some nice friendships and made some great connections through social media. I know that's part of what you do for a living, but there's also this idea that so many people are connected virtually, but they're not connected in real life anymore. So the fact that you've met people online and then met them in person is a great testimony to the goodness of social media.
Yeah, I would say, just as an encouragement, be a good neighbor before you be a good social media person. meet people locally, you know, whether that's through your local church in a community group setting or a Sunday school setting or something like that, or literally your next door neighbor, the guy who lives in the apartment above you or whatever. Building relationships with people online is great, and I've been blessed to to make a number of friendships through social media and writing and things on the internet. But I think it's important that we are good neighbors first and good church people first before we go trying to make friends with people halfway across the country or the world, just because, you know, we might not have to experience their mess, or they may not intrude on our house like we, you know, like neighbors can or friends or family can that live near us.
Mm-hmm. Chris, we just have about a minute left. I would like for you to encourage our listeners that you can be a light in the darkness through social media.
Yeah, you know, it takes some intentional steps. You're not going to be a light in the darkness on accident. We're sinful. Social media is not a perfect medium. It encourages brevity. It does not encourage dialogue. It's not easy to have constructive conversations. But social media can be a really dark place, and I think it's important that Christians participate in the platforms, whatever you may prefer, Instagram, Facebook, or otherwise, to shine the light of the gospel, because Christians shouldn't shy away simply because it may not be fun or we may not like social media, but perhaps we can shine the light of the gospel there and glorify God in that space. I think that's important.
I agree. Chris Martin, thank you so much for being on the show. I'll talk to you again soon, my friend.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
Yep. That was Chris Martin, millennial evangelical. He works as an author of development specialist at Lifeway Research, Lifeway Christian Resources. We'll take a short break and be back coming up at 20 minutes to. We've got Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog. Spit it out, Bill. There we go. Be back in a minute. It is half past the hour. Bill Arnold here with you this morning. I want to take a little news break, and then we're getting history lesson. Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog is going to be with us, and we're going to get a little lesson in history. Looking forward to that. Be back in a minute. I say a little prayer for you. Good morning. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. When we put our faith in anything other than Jesus, it will always end up leaving us unfulfilled. Neil Cole says more.
We put so much faith in behavior modification. And if you put your faith in something other than Christ, you will grow something other than Christ. And so we're not putting faith in the gospel. We're not putting faith in Christ. We're putting faith in our process, in our program, in our curriculum, in our opinions, in our behavior modification, in our moral stances. Well, that's not faith in Christ. And the results, the fruit shows, there's so little fruit to bear for that. And we come off as being proud, arrogant, stubborn people that are so narrow-minded they can look through a keyhole with both eyes. It just is not making a difference in the world.
You want to hear that full interview with Neil Cole? Go to our website, myfaithradio.com, and type in Neil Cole, or you can type in one thing. Hopefully that will get you to that interview. You can hear it in its entirety. All right. I just saw a long black limousine pull up, which means Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog must be here. So that's up next. Be back in a minute.
Ever feel like you're the only family around who has problems? Well, relax. I heard someone say recently, the only normal families in the world are those you don't know very well. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Don't spend undue energy fussing over your imperfections. If you have conflict in your home, you're perfectly normal. Hey, most parents are surprised when those little innocent ones begin to act out their newfound independence as young adults. Teens say stuff and do stuff that's sometimes shocking. But don't make the mistake of thinking that you're the only family who's struggling. Trust me, lots of parents are struggling. Keep the end goal in mind.
Is your teen bored, lazy, or glued to video games this summer? Get Mark Gregston's list of 6 ways to make the most of summer with your teen. Download your free copy online at ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Minutes until the top of the hour. I have Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog in studio with me right now. He's the history chair here at the University of Northwestern. And when you're the history chair, you ride in style. How was the limo ride?
The ride was great. If by that we mean a over 10-year-old vehicle with over 160,000 miles on it that I drove myself.
Yeah.
So the limo ride was great. I have no complaints.
Making that crystal clear, aren't you? Nice to have you here in studio.
It's great to be here
again. Thank you so much. So you are a history chair here at University of Northwestern, so we're thinking school is underway pretty soon?
Things are building. There's a growing excitement on campus. Student leaders are back. Some athletes are back. Faculty will be meeting next week, and our new class of students will be back on campus next Friday. So we are really excited. 1 week from today.
Very cool. All right. As you know, Jonathan, there's lots of things to discuss going on with what's happening in Charlottesville and the taking down of statues. I'd love to get your take on that.
Right. Well, my first thing to say is, wow, there are a lot of strands going on.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's why that requires sustained conversation, not just a single tweet.
Not one and done, huh?
Not one and done. Yep. We can't solve it. So there are a lot of pieces going there. Since you raised Charlottesville, let's start by saying, first of all, that any claims of racial discrimination or racial superiority, inferiority, we need to condemn.
Mm-hmm.
We need to start there. We also need to say any violence against political opponents, we need to condemn. So I just want to be straight on that first thing. Boy, asking about monuments, that's kind of the question of the day, isn't it?
Well, it is, and you're the historian, so I'm very interested in your perspective, historian and Christian, so there we go.
Right. So we'll do our best to unpack that as much as we can. As a historian, I'd actually start by saying, well, what is the history of these monuments
mm-hmm.
that we're talking about? Now, a lot of them were not put up by the people who were involved in the Civil War or even by their immediate family members. Many of them were actually put up in the 20th century later on. And so they were doing some other type of work than simply being a remembrance of the specific people who were involved in the war. So I think that's a really interesting insight that they don't necessarily date to the 1860s, 70s. They might, a lot of them date to the 1920s and some of them even to the 1950s and even 1960s. And the way I understand that is for some of the people involved, not all, but for some of them, it was maybe even less about the Civil War than about the political issues that were being raised in the 20th century along questions of segregation or the civil rights movement. So we have to understand that too.
Mm-hmm.
So these monuments are not simply a sacred space that went up from the blood of Civil War people involved. They were later creations. And so I think that allows us to hopefully lower the temperature and say, well, we can think about these a little bit more critically.
Mm-hmm. I would like you to respond to this. A friend of mine sent me this tweet. It's by a guy named Jeff Jones. It said, "Black people who were never slaves are fighting white people who were never Nazis over a Confederate statue erected by Democrats because Democrats can't stand their own history anymore, and yet somehow it's Trump's fault."
I'd have to think about that tweet a little bit.
I get it.
But I think there's a lot of blame to go around. And so rather than casting stones, I want to kind of think as constructively as possible to say, how can we do this kind of as a community, as a nation? And I guess I'd also lower the temperature and say, well, let's let every city determine what they think is best for their monument, or let's let every state determine what's best for their monument.
Mm-hmm.
So to some extent, I don't feel in a position to tell somebody in another state what they should do or how they should think about their monument.
Sure. Okay, let's look back at the Civil War then and the history of slavery in America.
Right. So we can't get away from the existence of slavery in America. I mean, I think that's a given. And in fact, when I teach history, U.S. history part one, as I will do starting in just 2 weeks, the significance of slavery for early America is something that we pay attention to quite a bit. We find out interesting facts like at the American Revolution in 1775-76, slavery is legal in every colony, every state. And so people as far north as Massachusetts, New Hampshire own slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting
– That's very interesting.
Piece to note.
Yes.
So then what changed? And what changed was that in the American Revolutionary period and in the decades following, northern states said this practice of slavery is inconsistent with our principles, both as stated in the Declaration of Independence and in our Christian commitments. And so they made moves to eliminate slavery. And so then New York is the last state to do this in the 1790s. By 1800, then, you see a strong regional divide between North and South. So that's one distinction. A second is that the nature of slavery was really changing up to about 1800 as primarily tobacco was becoming less and less profitable. People like George Washington were saying, hey, the future's in wheat. And you know what? Wheat development is a lot different for the way you use labor than tobacco is. So slavery was on a decline until the invention of Eli Whitney's cotton gin and the development of cotton agriculture, which then causes a huge explosion and slavery goes west.
Mm-hmm. So economics will continue to play a big part in the slavery discussion, won't it?
It really was. And so then you look at antebellum slavery, we make sure to point out how evil it was. And I think we should use the word evil in regard to it. And the way we do that is by listening to people who were involved, who knew about it. People like Frederick Douglass or Harriet Jacobs, that these were people who lived under slavery and then were able to find voices to explain to the rest of Americans why it was such an evil institution.
Jonathan, you have such a gift of speaking so plainly and clearly. And so I appreciate the way you're helping us process this. If you have a question for the professor, you might want to give us a call, 1-877-933-2484. You can also email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. We'll get your question on the air for Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog, the history professor here at the University of Northwest. Good morning. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. I've got Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog in studio with me today. Always looking forward to that. Always love having him here. Professor, let's talk about Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson versus George Washington and Thomas Jefferson.
Right. And this is one of those questions that has also come up, right? Are we on a slippery slope that if we start critiquing some people and remember how we remember them, where does it end? And I think this is somewhat of a fair question because key thing that I've been thinking about was actually expressed on the Breakpoint section just earlier this hour,
mm-hmm.
where you're never going to find a perfectly 100% upright, never did evil individual. Just as even the worst people might have some positive traits. So then, how do we remember flawed individuals?
Mm-hmm.
And was there slavery ownership across the board? Yes. The Washington owned slaves, Jefferson did. Robert E. Lee did. Stonewall Jackson did. And of course, many of the bigger monuments are of Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Well, these are really interesting, complex people. And there are ways apart from the slavery issue that I find them compelling individuals, that they both had faith and they both were gentlemen in many ways who desired the improvement of their communities and even expressed some concern for the enslaved people that they oversaw. So let's give them credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
But they then made a choice, which I think is a wrong choice and a tragic choice, to throw in their lot with the Confederacy rather than fight for the Union. And in Lee's case, this was starkly put. Within the space of just a few days, he received invitations to lead both the Union Army and the Confederate Army. And he chose, because of his loyalties to Virginia, to stick with the Confederacy. And I think that was a tragic choice. As a result, I would see them as decent men in a really bad cause.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can generally, I definitely think they're open to criticism, even though I want to see the positives in their lives as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think of all Confederate monuments in that way, yeah, I think they could also be lumped in with others. Now, there are also some very evil men involved in evil causes. A great example of that, I think, is Nathan Bedford Forrest, who went on to found the Ku Klux Klan. And there are some Nathan Bedford Forrest monuments out there. Mm-hmm. I think I might be on the forefront of asking those to be removed and placed someplace else.
Mm-hmm. What do we do with Robert Byrd? He's got his name on 28 buildings and streets and everything else.
Right.
Just to clarify,
Byrd was a long-term West Virginia senator who did have a Ku Klux Klan membership in his background.
He was a recruiter. Yeah.
Right. So here would be another example of beware when we keep digging, right? You're going to find a lot of problems in people in public life.
Mm-hmm. We've got a caller, Dean from Fargo. Dean, welcome to the show. Hi, Dean. Welcome.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, you have a question for
the professor. I just
wanted
to bring up the point that slavery is not unique to the colonists or the Americans, because Native American Indians practiced slavery long before the white guy came here. Sacagawea was a slave.
Okay. Jonathan, his question was addressing the issue of slavery by Native Americans before the colonial era.
Good question, right? And when we look, we see that there are these complexities in regard to slavery.
Mm-hmm.
That did Native Americans hold slaves? In some cases, they did, right? On two levels. There was regular raids among Native American tribes to steal captives to join to their tribes. So that example – now, sometimes those – people who were kidnapped were actually inducted into the new tribe. So there was forced relocation of people among Indian tribes. The other piece that people will point out is that in some areas, especially in the deep Southwest, some tribes, including the Cherokee, engaged in plantation slavery, where in the antebellum period, some Native Americans did also hold African American slaves. So what it points to is that there's a lot of kind of complexity in these relationships, and so we can recognize that without I think going to a point of moral equivalency. There definitely were some complexities going
mm-hmm.
on.
Jonathan, another question. A caller writes in and says, "Can we know for what purpose the monuments in question were created? I feel like that should determine whether or not they get taken down."
Yeah, I think that's a good perspective. And maybe it again suggests, let's look at this at a case-by-case basis, right? That here's a great area for local history research. And so I guess I would challenge every community to do that. And in fact, I've read some of these. For instance, there was a wide open discussion in the city of New Orleans when their monuments went up in the 1870s, so they were much older. Versus in Charlottesville, actually, where some of the debates are happening, there was a public discussion, and the people who put the monuments up said, "We honor Lee for some things, and we criticize him for others." So they knew what they were doing. There are others, again, as I said, which were later, and I've seen some. I can think of one that I've personally seen in Alabama that was very clearly put up much later with a negative intent.
Okay. Another question. How do we think biblically about our heroes and their moral failings, our human leaders' accomplishments we're celebrating, even if their actions and attitudes were sinful?
Yeah. That's a great question. Give that reader a gold star.
Gold star.
Gold star.
Yeah.
Because this is something that we talk about a lot in class. And what it tells us is that even while we respect accomplishments that our leaders make, we want to be careful how much of a pedestal we put them on, right? And think about monuments as kind of a good line. How much of a pedestal do we put them on?
Mm-hmm.
Because every individual, the line of sin runs through every human heart. And so even the best are going to be flawed. And so that should make us humble and also say we're not bound to follow any human leader, right? That we can find our authority elsewhere, again, in the scriptures.
Mm-hmm. How can we learn from the sins of our past, and how should we be erasing them from the public eye? And maybe the best question of all is, what's the best way to craft a better future?
Yeah, all good question, right? Because they're speaking to what we do now, and I think that's really the impulse that people have.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first points I'm going to suggest is grieving, actually. My heart has been grieving this week, and Christians can lament when we see the negative effects of sin. Then I think there can be steps forward. We say, yeah, we want to seek reconciliation. Now, part of that is listening. We need to listen to people who feel hurt, injured. I don't think dealing with these monuments by itself will heal these hurts. But if our brothers and sisters are saying, this is harmful, then maybe we should craft a solution to do that. Now, my quick take is that for the places that they'll be removed, let's move them to museums or cemeteries where they're out of the way but not destroyed. I don't want them destroyed because I want to find a way that we can remember them there too.
Mm-hmm.
How can we build something better? Well, you know, this is the other message I think really sticks for Faith Radio is the church has to model something different. And I want the church to be the model where people of different backgrounds, different racial and ethnic identities can come together because they have a unity that's built not even in a national identity, but in Christ.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming in. Please come by more often, if you wouldn't mind.
I would be delighted.
Yeah, because I learned so much when you come in, and I take notes, and I want to thank the callers and thank some of the callers that didn't get on the program this morning. I'm sorry about that. With a lot of interest in your subject this morning.
Definitely,
so thank you so much.
This is a great class conversation.
It is indeed. Jonathan Den Hartog, have a great day. We'll take a short break and be back to wrap up the show. Thanks for being with us today. We've got a great day planned on Faith Radio. Got a lot of great programming starting with Colin Smith in just a few minutes, and then we've got Connecting Faith at Noon and Susie Larson in the afternoon. Have a great, great weekend. Thanks for listening. I will see you Monday. Thanks for being with us today. I want to leave you with Psalm 119. In verse 14, it says, I rejoice in following your statutes as one rejoices in great riches. So God's laws and decrees we should be rejoicing in more than even riches. And it says in 15, I meditate on your precepts and consider your ways. I delight in your decrees. I will not neglect your word. Have a great weekend. Don't neglect his word. I will see you Monday morning. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.